I would like to start by thanking the organizers for giving me the chance to speak. I would like to tell you about a series of works that I wrote with various collaborators, and also by papers about papers by other people. There are many references, but I would like to point you to a recent review article that I wrote with my colleagues, and I think chapter 9 in this review contains much more than I will tell you today about the subject. So let's start. My talk is going to be probably very different from most of the talks at this very nice conference. The reason is that, despite of the fact that I will be talking about quantum field theory, the resurgent phenomena and divergent series are not going to be series in the coupling constant. They're not going to be expansions in the coupling constant. They're going to be expansions in time, or they're going to be gradient expansions, that is, hydrodynamic gradient expansion. So the motivation for whatever I have to tell you comes from experiment. And this experiment are ultra-relativistic collisions of heavy ions at RIC and LHC that started around the year 2000. And these experiments test our theoretical understanding of QCD under extreme conditions, under very high energies, and very dense matter. So one of the punchlines of these experiments is that, according to our best description, these experiments created the quark-gluon plasma. And this quark-gluon plasma, to cut the long story short, evolves according to the laws of hydrodynamics. So for many of you, probably the story of eta over s equals 1 over 4 pi rings somewhat a bell. And this comes about from theoretical attempts to help to understand this problem, not in the language of QCD, but actually in the language of holography, in the language of N equal 4 supernatural theory and its cousins that are soluble using gravitational duals. So the basic question that I would like to address in this talk is a question, what actually hydrodynamics is, how to think about it properly, and what are the conditions for its applicability. And when it comes to hydrodynamics, I will be interested not in general flows, but actually in flows that are relevant for the experiments. So this will be expanding plasma setups, such as the ones created in heavy ion collisions. And when it comes to particular theories, which I will be using to describe such flows, I'll be focused on N equal 4 supernatural mules at large number of colors and strong coupling. And I will be also using a particular model that contains some features of N equal 4 supernatural mules under the name of BRS3 theory. And I'll be much more clear on this transparency. So let me start by providing a textbook definition of hydrodynamics. By textbook, I mean something close to Landau-Lifshitz. So I'll be talking about relativistic hydrodynamics. The reason for it is that, first, the medium that is created in heavy ion collisions is a medium whose microscopic constituents can move at relativistic speeds. And second, because the speeds that the medium itself can achieve in as a result of expansion can be large. I mean, comparable to the speed of light, of large fraction to the speed of light. So that's why we talk about relativistic hydrodynamics. And according to, say, Landau-Lifshitz, hydrodynamics is an effective field theory of the slow, and I put here a quotation mark, evolution of conserved currents in collective media close to equilibrium. So there are two question marks, and these question marks have to do with, on one hand, what's been observed or what's been observed when trying to describe the experiment. On the other hand, based on the results from holography, in particular the results that were delivered earlier by Larry Affe and then his student Paul Chesler, and later by the group I was part in. So the idea that it's a description of a system close to equilibrium and of a conserved current is that we wait for long enough, and when we wait for long enough, like most of the information about what's been happening initially is going to be forgotten in the system, dissipated away. And then the only thing that's going to matter are conserved quantities such as energy and momentum, and maybe conserved charges if present in the system. And then slow, because we wait for long enough if we want it to be applicable, and then everything is going to be basically very close to equilibrium. So when it comes to degrees of freedom, these are always, conserved quantities, that is local energy density and momentum. And here instead, we're going to talk about the flow velocity. And when it comes to equations of motion, these are conservation equations for the expectation value of the angular-momentum tensor operator in a quantum field theory, where this expectation value is expanded in gradients. So that's the part where this notion of smallness comes about. The starting point is the angular-momentum tensor of the perfect fluid. This angular-momentum tensor is an angular-momentum tensor of something in local thermal equilibrium. You can see it in two ways. One way to see it is that if you diagonalize this angular-momentum tensor, you're going to see that the eigenvalues are epsilon, p, p, and p. That is, like, all the pressures are equal, as in local thermal equilibrium. And then secondly, given this angular-momentum tensor, there exists a conserved current on shell, that is the entropy current. So there's no production of entropy in such a system. And then this is the reason why, on top of this perfect fluid angular-momentum tensor, you add derivative corrections. And these derivative corrections introduce dissipations, that is, they introduce entropy production. And they also introduce the decay with time at the same point, at the same moment. So up to the first ordering derivatives of velocity and temperature, in general, there are only two terms permitted. One is basically a response of your fluid to shearings, so to basically derivatives perpendicular to velocity, and the other is a response of your fluid to expansion. The scalar coefficient in front are called the shear viscosity and bulk viscosity, and then you can keep going and you can add second order terms, that is terms having two derivatives of velocity and temperature, three, and so on and so forth. So the topic of my presentation here is the behavior of the gradient expansion, so expansion derivatives of velocity and temperature at large orders of these derivatives. Large, I mean 200, several hundred. One caveat for this is that in practical applications, so when you want to solve equations of fluid dynamics, you're not really solving these equations. And the reason for it is that these equations, given a derivative expansion that maybe at some point you want to truncate, do not have a well-posed initial value problems. They are not hyperbolic. And in order to get hyperbolic equations of motion, what you do is you basically replace whatever sits there on top of the perfect fluid piece, so all this block, by a new dynamical variable, and then you write a phenological equation for this new dynamical variable, so for the so-called shear part of the angular-momentum tensor, and an equation is of such a form that if you solve this new equation of motion in gradient expansion, you're gonna recover what's been here up to a desired order, so say first or second. And the most general attempt to do this up to second order in the context of microscopic conformal field theories is the so-called BRS3 theory from 2007. And this is the theory of the following form. And up to second order in derivative expansion, it gives precisely what can be derived microscopically. So basically, I got to this business through seeing plots like this. So this plot contains several curves. So the brown curves, the dashed brown curves, are solutions of gauge theory ab initio undergoing expansion, like in Hevian collision, using holography. So we solve Einstein's equations numerically on a computer. And using the language of holographic duality, we obtain the form of the expectation value of the stress tensor for such a general solution. And then we plot it as a function of basically time. And then what I'm depicting for you here is how big is the difference between pressures in your system? So if you are close to local thermal equilibrium, all the pressures are equal. By pressures, I mean just the eigenvalues of the stress sensor that have space-like eigenvectors. In equilibrium, all the pressures are, in local equilibrium, all the pressures are equal. And then, okay, pressure is a dimensionful quantity, so we have to gauge it against something else that is dimensionless, so it's not dimensionful, so I gauge it against what would be the pressure in equilibrium. And then we see that initially we start with something that, well, is very anisotropic, right? And then it's gonna decay, and then at some point, as you see, all these curves seem to join together. And then what they see, the moment when they seem to join together, is a moment where they join actually the form of the energy momentum tensor expanded in gradient truncated at the first order. So the moment when they join together with magenta curve is the moment when first order viscous hydrodynamics works. So that's basically the criterion for the applicability of hydrodynamics, right? When these curves join the magenta curve, then we say that hydrodynamics becomes applicable. But the remarkable thing about this plot is that when the brown and as well blue curves join together with the magenta one, the anisotropy in the system is order one. So as I said, initially hydrodynamics was motivated as an expansion on top of equilibrium when dynamics is slow, gradients are small. Over here we see that the truncated gradient expansion at the lowest non-trivial order is capable of reproducing the ab initio calculation without any assumption about what kind of dynamics is happening in the regime where gradients are actually of the order one. So this basically prompted a large interest in the community for various reasons. So one reason is that in heavy ion collisions, hydrodynamic codes are initialized very early on. And since they're initialized very early on, you expect naturally that very early on the gradients are large. And if you want to apply hydrodynamic codes in such a regime, then it's better to have an example of a controllable study such as this one, in which hydrodynamics actually works when gradients are large, so like there's a tick. And the second thing, and this is something that is a bit non-trivial, is that because hydrodynamics seems to work, so truncated gradient expansion seems to give rise to a satisfactory description of the microscopic physics, in the regime where gradients are large, that is in the regime where the stress sensor does not have a form epsilon PPP, so local thermal equilibrium, that means that basically applicability of hydrodynamics, that is this hydrodynamization, has to be distinct from local thermalization. So this basically gave rise to the question how to think properly about the gradient expansion and how to think properly about the applicability of hydrodynamics and how to think properly about stuff that is not described by truncated gradient expansion, right? And that's basically where this notion of trans series is gonna enter the game. So before I move on to this, let me discuss the following thing. So hydrodynamics is not everything. I mean, we saw that the curve given by hydrodynamics was not matching the curves that we got by solving the problem ab initio. That means that apart from these hydrodynamic solutions, there is much more going on in your system. So one way to get a handle on this is to consider your theory and look at small perturbations of equilibrium solution. So equilibrium solution is going to be a solution at finite temperature in global equilibrium. And then on top of this, you put tiny wiggles. I mean, like you perturb your system a bit. And you ask the question, what are the eigenfrequency of such small perturbations? So we work in Fourier space, both in space and time. And we ask the question, what are the permitted eigenfrequency of the system? The systems are dissipative by construction. So as a result, these eigenfrequencies are going to be complex. And their imaginary part are going to be responsible for dissipation, that is, in this case, decay with time. And then the first theory that we're going to address is the so-called BRS3 theory. So this theory was obtained by playing with, you know, gradient expansion and tried to replace the gradient expansion by something that has a well-posed initial value problem. So we took the equations of this theory, and then we look at linearization on top of equilibrium. And here are the answers. So the answer is that there are basically two kinds of eigenfrequencies permitted in the system. One eigenfrequency is purely imaginary. That means that this stuff is going to decay exponentially with time. And then two others are both real and imaginary. But they have a property that when the momentum of your perturbation goes to zero, then these frequencies go to zero. That means by making the momentum of your perturbation arbitrarily small, you make the decay rate arbitrarily small. So these two frequencies are nothing more than a manifestation of hydrodynamic solutions, hydrodynamic equations of motion, at the level of linear response theory. But on top of them, on top of the stuff that is in principle slowly evolving and slowly decaying, there is a possibility of having things that are exponentially suppressed with time. And you can repeat similar studies in holography. So this was a really simple theory. Now holography is a much more difficult setup because what you need to solve are Eichner's equation in higher number of dimensions. But this can be done. This was done already 12 years ago. And what appears there is that there are infinitely many exponentially suppressed modes. Still there is a finite number, actually two, of perturbations which can be made arbitrarily long-lived, and these perturbations are manifestations of linearized solutions of equations of hydrodynamics. So basically the punchline of this is that in collective media, described either by holography or by this theory called BRS3, there are two kinds of modes. There are modes that can be made arbitrarily long-lived as the momentum of perturbation is taken to zero, or wavelength to be large, and these are manifestations of linearized solutions of hydro, of this gradient expansion of the stress tensor, and conservation of thereof. And there are, in principle, many, sometimes infinitely many, like in holography, or just one, as in the case of BRS3 theory, of modes that are exponentially decaying over some time scale. In this case, in the case of conformal theories, this time scale is given by the inverse of temperature. And the last thing that I would like to take home from this transparency is that this exponentially decaying stuff is nothing more in the context of holography and N=4 as quasi-neural modes of the dual black holes. So now let's move on to the interesting part, that is to the trans series. So we already seen it in the second transparency, that is the setup that we're going to consider is a one-dimensional expansion of matter. So imagine that this is the expansion axis along the expansion of matter occurs. This is time. So this is where the collision happened, and then the stuff is going to move inside this light cone. But in order to simplify our life, we're going to make an additional assumption. That is, we're going to make an assumption that the matter looks the same in any reference frame that is boosted along the expansion axis. So this assumption goes under the name of boost invariant assumption, or that was introduced by Bjorkane in 1982. And the reason for this is that now the dynamics, instead of depending separately on time and position along the expansion axis, is going to just depend on the unique boost invariant combination of these two variables. So as a result, in this one-dimensional expanding setup, the dynamics is going to just depend on one coordinate. So sometimes our equations are going to reduce to ODEs, sometimes our equations are going to be just PDEs in two variables, right? So this is a huge simplification that's going to allow for almost semi-analytic treatment. And now, because of the underlying conformal symmetry that we want to introduce to simplify our life, the pressure anisotropy normalized to what would be equilibrium pressure is going to be just a function of this Boose invariant time variable, so of proper time. But now, since we want to operate at the level of scaling variant quantities, we want to gauge this time variable against some dimensional scale, so we take it to be what would be the equilibrium temperature in the system. So this W variable is very nice because in the context of this dynamics, The gradient expansion is going to be expansion in the inverse powers of 1 over w. So this is a late-time expansion, but when the dust settles, the pressure anisotropy is going to have an expansion in powers of 1 over w. So that's also the reason why in the previous transparencies, I was looking at the curve that was behaving like 1 over w. So now let's take this BRS3 theory that I introduced, and let's rewrite it in terms of pressure anisotropy and w. And it turns out that after the dust settles, the equations of motion of this theory, the interesting content of the equation of motion of this theory, can be reduced to the ODE for pressure, first order ODE for pressure anisotropy as a function of w. And now what you can do is you can look for the solutions of these equations of motion in a power series in 1 over w. And searching for a solution for equations of motion in a power series in 1 over w is nothing more than just searching for a solution of, for a formal solution in the language of gradient expansion. That is like subsequent powers of 1 over w or subsequent orders of the gradient expansion. So 1 over w corresponds to just including shear viscosity. 1 over w squared corresponds to including terms having two derivatives of velocity and temperature, and so on and so forth. And now we can make a plot. And what's going to turn out is that the coefficients in this 1 over w expansion exhibit factorial growth with the order. So this basically is a result that tells us that the gradient expansion in relativistic hydrodynamics has a zero radius of convergence, is a divergent series. And what we noticed before is that the first non-trivial term in this expansion gives rise to the extreme accurate prediction of the form of energy momentum tensor in the regime where the anisotropy is huge. The other orders, at least in these setups, did not matter that much. So when we saw this result, we were a bit puzzled. The reason for it is that we didn't have that much experience with divergent series. So we tried to work it out by ourselves. So the two key observations that probably are going to be obvious for most of the community here is that the sum over all gradients does not make sense without the resummation. I mean, it's a divergent series. We have to resum it in order to make sense out of it. And one thing that is important is that the sum of the gradient expansion does not have any information about the initial condition. But the equation we started with is a first-order ordinary differential equation. That is, you need to specify at an initial value of w an initial condition. So the reason is that there must be something else in the system, apart from the gradient expansion, that's going to care about the initial condition. And indeed, there is something like this. That is, you can take this equation and linearize on top of this formal solution given by the sum of the infinite gradient expansion. And after the dust settled, what you're going to find is that there is something that is exponentially suppressed in w, so exponentially suppressed with time, that is multiplied by a gradient expansion on its own. So the interpretation of this guy is nothing more than it's a transient excitation that is exponentially suppressed in time that we saw before. But now it's dressed because it's an excitation not on top of the equilibrium, but it's an excitation on something that is already expanding. So you should think about this divergent series that multiplies it as a dressing, because this stuff is not really living on top of equilibrium solution or equilibrium configuration, but on top of something that is dynamical on its own. So to wrap up this transparency, we have just seen the hydro-dressed transient mode in this BRS3 theory. And now comes the fun part of trans-series. That is, we can take the Borel transform of the Borel transform of the divergent gradient expansion, and we can then perform a approximate analytic continuation using PADA approximants. So we take basically 200 terms and we look at the ratio of 100-100 polynomials. And then what I'm plotting for you here are the singularities of this approximate analytic continuation. And you see these singularities lie on the real axis. And now, of course, This is non-borrow-summable, but I think about borrow-summability as basically a red herring. But depending on what contour you take in the inverse Borel transform, then you're going to get different answers. But it turns out that these answers differ by nothing more by the inclusion of the of this non-hydro non-hydro excitation. So as a result, after the dust settles, what we are led to is that the general solution for your microscopic equations of motion can be given by the gradient expansion. That's like just the one term that does not involve any free parameters, apart from parameters that are going to occur when you resum it. And on top of this, you're going to get this non-hydro transient mode. And then the equation is highly nonlinear. So apart from this transient mode, you're going to have like the square of this transient mode, cube of this transient mode, and so on and so forth. So the general solution to this equations of motion, it takes the form of the transseries. And you can play with it, and you can show that actually the result of this transseries after a summation is unambiguous up to a choice of one real integration constant. And that's precisely the integration constant that you need to specify in order to specify what kind of a solution of your theory you're talking about. So that was the simple case that actually we encountered a posteriori. But we started these investigations by looking at holography, so much more involved case. And in holography, we played the same game. That is, we constructed the gradient expansion. The gradient expansion was also divergent. We had 240 terms. And now I'm plotting for you the singularities of the analytic approximate analytic continuation of the Borel transform. And what you see here is that these singularities are much more rich. And basically, as I told you, in holography, there are infinitely many transient excitations, transient quasi-normal modes, so exponentially decaying. And it turns out that the leading singularity is going to be given by the leading transient quasi-normal mode. But then on top of this, you also see two things. So one thing are the second and possibly higher quasi-normal modes. But on the other hand, equations are nonlinear. So still, what you're going to see are integer multiples of the fundamental frequency. So this is something that you actually see. And then this is basically the conjecture. The conjecture is that the most general solution of Einstein's equations with negative cosmological constant in this context can be written as a transseries with infinitely many parameters. And the reason why you have infinitely many parameters is because you have infinitely many modes. The key difference between this setup and the previous setup is that in the previous setup, this transient mode was purely decaying, whereas in the context of holography, these modes are both decaying and oscillating. So having seen all this, that led us to a question, how to think properly about hydrodynamics, right? Because the gradient expansion by itself doesn't really make sense. You have to resum it. So a poor man's vision of doing hydro is to consider the gradient expansion and truncate it arbitrarily, right, and try to play with it. Or maybe there's something more deep. It turns out that there seems to be something more deep, and this is a story that is only picking up recently, because we can look at various solutions of the microscopic models. So this is this BRS3 theory that I treat on par with holography as a microscopic model. And these different blue curves are different solutions corresponding to different initial conditions. Now, hydrodynamics, so truncated at the first order, is given by the magenta curve. And then it turns out that when you look at this, actually you're going to also notice something that is an attractor solution, that is a basically division between what's happening here, divisor between what's happening here and what's happening there. And this attractor solution actually is a solution that you can also generate in a sort of a gradient expansion. But this gradient expansion is not going to be expansion in standard gradient, so 1 over W, so Taylor expansion. But actually, it's going to be an expansion in which, in the equation of motion, you neglect derivative, and then you try to include it subsequently as a correction. So it turns out that this attractor can be obtained in this so-called slow roll approximation. So probably I wouldn't be telling about this if not a very recent result by Paul Romaczka, who found such attractor solutions in kinetic theory and also in holography. So that seems to be a bit more general than this. So now you can ask the question whether this attractor is any special. And it turns out that it's actually complicated. That is, the choice of the transduce parameter that you have to make in order to match this attractor is kind of random, as it's this number. So what I'm trying to say is that from the point of view of the transduce, we do not see any reason why this particular value of the transduce parameter corresponds to an attractor or not. But we clearly see at the level of solutions of equations of motion that an attractor is a sort of a special solution. So let me summarize. I think it's the right time to summarize. So what I've been discussing is a basically triangle of ideas that is motivated by experimental studies of ultra-relativistic heavy-ion collisions at RIC and LHC. So this triangle is spanned by the phenomenon of hydrodynamization that was first discovered using holography, that is applicability of naive truncated gradient expansion in the regime where gradients are really huge, and corresponding usage of hydrodynamic models to describe heavy-ion collision data in the regime where gradients are large. The second part of the triangle is basically this notion of transduces, in which we supplement the gradient expansion by transient exponentially suppressed modes, such that only the gradient expansion plus these suppressed modes to altogether make sense. They do not make sense without each other. And the third part of this triangle is this notion of hydrodynamics outside local thermal equilibrium, that is these attractor solutions. So one appealing analogy that I would like to close with is an analogy with quantum mechanical systems. So in non-equilibrium physics setup that I told you about, the gradient expansion is expansion in 1 over W, whereas transient excitations are excitations that are exponential in 1 over 1 over W. So now if you want to make an analogy with quantum mechanical systems such as an anharmonic oscillator, in anharmonic oscillator, if you were to search for the, say, ground state energy or something similar, then you would construct it as a perturbative series in G. And then on top of this, you would have, say, instant correction of the following form, right? So an analogy between quantum mechanical system and the non-equilibrium physics is such that the perturbative, the coupling constant is basically the gradient, whereas the non-perturbative excitations, such as instanton, renormals, et cetera, are going to correspond to the transient excitations that are gone from the dynamics after a timescale of the order of inverse of temperature here. So let me close with this one, and thank you for your attention.
Question. Do you think there is any way that in the holographic setup that you can, studying the transduces, you can get any information about the hydro loops, like the renormalized viscosity and things like that?
Well, hydro loops would appear, I mean, you would, when you try to derive this series, the question is whether you include or not include such effects, right? Over here, we decided not to include them, and we had a good reason for it, which is 1 over n. I guess if you were to obtain the transient effect at, say, 1 over n level, then you would learn something about the structure of the gradient expansion, including such a loop correction at large orders. But I don't think anything more clever to say about this. Thanks for the question.
Thanks.
Would you like to comment about applications to PDEs, say, in the holographic equations?
Yeah, very good. So that's something that we haven't thought about much. The way it was solved, so maybe I should say first this, is that we look at, so of course, like the way holography works is that this dynamics on the boundary, the dynamics of 3+1 dimensional field theory, is gonna be mapped into the dynamics of 4+1 dimensional background. The dynamics on the field theory side depends only on one variable, that is this proper time tau, or this W variable. Whereas on the gravity, we have also the radial direction in ADS. So the way the Einstein's equations were solved, they were solved as a series expansion in 1 over W. And then each coefficient in 1 over W was a function of the radial variable. So in this sense, we basically applied research and techniques to PDEs. But we're looking at the interesting structures only in one of the variables in these PDEs. I'm not sure there was more to it than what I said, but I must say that the really puzzling setup in which I would like to see the use or the appearance of resurgence is the so-called is the kinetic theory. So as we progress with this program, we address the question of large order behavior gradient expansion in holography, so strongly coupled gauge theories at large n, in various toy models, such as this BRS3 theory. And then the framework relevant for weakly coupled gauge theories is the kinetic theory. So here we use like a toy model of a weakly coupled gauge theory dynamics, that is the so-called RTA kinetic theory. And it turns out that the equations of motion in this case are basically partial integral differential equations. So it's a very complicated structure. This is the Boltzmann equation. And it turns out that the structure of the things that are happening in this case are very rich and very interesting. So I would really love to hear from participants here whether the resurgent phenomena were observed in the context of integral equations, because the kinetic theory can be represented as a sort of an integral equation.
Comment, if you consider the matrix model, you could write down the effective hydrodynamic description for collective field theory for eigenvalues. And in that case, the gradient expansion is just 1 over n expansion.
Oh. So,
and in that case, the non-perturbative contribution in hydro you told about correspond to eigenvalue instanton in the matrix model. So there is a one-to-one correspondence in the collective behavior in the matrix model setup.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions, comments? No?
I had a comment actually related to Marino talk, and this is the comment about attractors in the context of holography, right? So I presented a sort of an attractor solution in a simple setup, but in the context of holography, it's been only constructed numerically and very crudely. And one idea that was pursued actually by my colleague Michal Spolinski was basically to take this. Analytic continuation of the Borel transform and perform the inverse transform just along the real axis, so like sort of like a minimal one. And it turns out that in a simple model that has similar structure of singularities, that was very close to the attractor. And in holography, it's also very close to the attractor. But I think the accuracy of attractors there is not sufficient in order to determine whether this is like really spot on or whether we are away from it by 10 to minus 10, as was the case in your summation. So basically what you said was very powerful, like, at least like on the way to think about this problem. Yeah, but you had a question as well.
Can we see just for a second your 11, the next one?
Okay.
Yeah, you were saying that this picture here.
Okay.
The value was found just by it was totally experimental.
Yes. So.
Yeah.
So shall I expand on this?
Well, I'm a bit curious. Is it a situation where you have also such an explicit nonlinear differential equation?
Oh yes. So of course. So the equation is basically this equation with this term. So it's a nonlinear ordinary differential equation. And the idea here is, on one hand, we can determine this attractor solution either numerically or semi-analytically by doing the slow roll approximation, that is neglecting the derivative terms and then including it perturbatively. And on the other hand, you can ask a question, what's the representation of this attractor solution at the level of trans-series? So what we did is we truncated the trans-series at the level of the square of the exponential term. So we kept the hadynamic part. We take the one instanton part, and in the language of quantum field theory or quantum mechanics, we kept also two instanton contributions, and we neglected all the subsequent contributions. And then we made sure that we can arrange contours in various Borel summation in such a way that the result is real, right, because we're after a real answer. So we made sure that this works. And then we ask a question, we have this trans-series parameter. This trans-series parameter is going to have a real part. What is the real part of this trans-series parameter that corresponds to an attractor? And you might say, okay, maybe zero is the right answer, right? I mean, like, that would be something that you would be not naively tempted to say, but it turns out that the answer is no, that it's not zero. It's something that is finite, and actually it's quite large. And we have no clue here why this particular choice for the real value of the trans-series parameter corresponds to an attractor solution. So what my colleague did in the context of this model, in the context of this model, like, he took the Borel summation over the real axis, and it turns out that for the trans-series parameter choice over here, where they are equal to zero, you get something that lies reasonably close to the attractor where you can trust it. But of course, like, it might well be that the accuracy of these attractors is not large enough in order to distinguish it from between zero and 10 to minus 10, right? So something that was the case in a previous talk. Yeah, thank you very much.